This week on Making Contact.
40% of the Egyptians are living below the poverty line, less than $1 per day. 4 months after revolution, they haven't feel any change. And this is why they are here today.
In February, a mass movement overthrew the hated dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. But a military council now rules the country. Critics say the new regime has kept much of Mubarak's repressive apparatus. Meanwhile, extremist Islamic groups are pressuring the government to adopt undemocratic right-wing policies. On this edition, Who Won the Egyptian Revolution? A documentary by independent producer Reese Ehrlich. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
A group of protesters sing and clap enthusiastically during a Tahrir Square rally in downtown Cairo. It's been 4 months since the revolution, and 200,000 mostly leftist and secular demonstrators are demanding an end to military rule. Tariq Shalabi, a well-known Tahrir Square leader, says the military is carrying out the same policies as Mubarak.
I'm completely against the Egyptian military, especially the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, which is basically the entity that's leading the country. They're brutally corrupt. They'll go out and wipe. They don't care. They could start shooting down and throwing Egyptians into prison on no charges just because they can, just because they want to control, and they want to keep the old regime. And so they're the biggest obstacle against the revolution.
Shaima Helmi, a biotechnology student, says the large turnout shows that the left and secular forces of the Egyptian revolution have ongoing support.
We feel like our revolution is being taken over by other people who didn't take part in it. And we feel like there's something wrong going on. So we're kind of trying to push the Supreme Council of Armed Forces. Around 10,000 civilians, most of them are youth, are facing military trials, which is something totally against what we are calling for.
Helmi and other demonstrators say their uprising was not a Facebook revolution. Most Egyptians don't have computers. At one point, the Mubarak government completely shut down the internet, yet those days saw the biggest demonstrations. Helmi says people mostly used word of mouth, text messaging, and Al Jazeera TV to spread the word.
They tend to think that only technology and Facebook and Twitter was the reason behind this, which is not true. Because if it wasn't for the support of people in the streets, nothing of this would have ever happened. Technology and social media was just a tool for this uprising, but if it wasn't for the people in the street, nothing would have ever happened.
Another protester, Khalid Shalid, says the revolution included many poor and working people with no access to Facebook. Today, they continue to demand economic justice.
40% of the Egyptians are living below the poverty line, less than $1 per day. 4 months after revolution, they haven't feel any change. And this is why they are here today. We are looking for a minimum wage, 1,200 pound. It represents about less than $200.
Demonstrators in Tahrir Square also strongly oppose U.S. interference in Egyptian affairs. The Obama administration backed dictator Hosni Mubarak until the last moment, they say, and has done little to help people since. Salma Shukrala is a journalist with the daily Al Ahram Online.
The link between the U.S. and the ruling regime here in Egypt, it has been often criticized and condemned. Of course, it was very clear to people, also by the end of the 18 days, that the U.S. was very keen on keeping things as is and keeping Mubarak, until they thought, oh no, this looks like a lost battle, so let's just switch, loyalties. You know, you can't actually have a real democracy in Egypt as long as this tie remains the same, because no economic changes will actually happen as long as Egypt is dictated from the U.S., because, the interests are very different.
The political and economic demands of Tahrir Square demonstrators resonate widely, nowhere more loudly than at the Manshait al-Bakri Hospital in Cairo.
As you can see, this is a common scene of the emergency.
Dr. Mohammed Shafiq stands in the middle of a chaotic emergency room with orderlies pushing patients on gurneys and guards standing in the hall. He says since the revolution, security for patients and doctors has become a major issue.
The fight in the hospitals was a common scene because when you came with your relative and you find there is no really health services given, when I ask you to buy cotton from a nearby pharmacy or to buy some syringe or buy some medicine because we lack the primary health services in our hospital, so you have to buy them. This will make you fight. This is a common thing. But the condition have become worse after the revolution because people have expected things to get better. But of course, it hasn't. And they are now more willing to fight. And what is the symbol of authority in a hospital other than a doctor? So they start to fight against us.
Dr. Shafiq says a dispute between two people might result in one coming to the hospital with a gunshot wound, and then the relatives of the shooter come into the hospital as well.
In many situations, there is a fight between two, and one of them is wounded and come to the hospitals. The relatives of the other one would come and finish him off in the hospital. In a couple of days in Almania, in Abra, Egypt, the patient was in the surgical, in the operating theater. He was taking a surgery, and his opponent came in. He pushed the doctor away, and he just finished him off on the table. So you can imagine. And the police is just standing and watching.
Doctors say that Egyptian police, once a key component in the repressive apparatus of Hosni Mubarak's dictatorship, now often refuse to carry out their jobs. Dr. Shafiq says it's a combination of timidity in the face of new conditions and a form of reprisal against those who overthrew the old regime.
That these police who shot the protesters, who killed them, have had not once or twice, but three increase in wages as like a kind of reward for what have they done, and still they would not like to do their job. It's like a kind of punishment that we have done a revolution and take their leader, the Minister of Interior, and put him in jail, you know?
As we walk through the hospital, Dr. Shafiq explains that hospital workers at Manshait al-Bakri decided to take matters into their own hands. Every public sector workplace in Egypt was run by a political appointee under the control of the Mubarak regime.
We have a small Mubarak in every hospital and in every administration that is taking most of the profit of the hospital, that is making his corruption legal, that is not caring about really what is the service giving to the citizen, but what is his superior is going to say about him. This is the kind of corruption that we are dealing with. And this was the experience that we had.
The doctors, nurses, clerks, and other staff at Manshait al-Bakri formed a hospital-wide union. Their first action was to remove the old administrator and elect a new one. Then, says Shafiq, they sent a fax to the Deputy Minister of Health.
And we told him that we had an election, we kicked off your old manager, and we will not tolerate anyone to be the manager of the hospital other than the one who is elected. We called the press, we said, well, you have two choices. Either you give up a fax that you have appointed this elected doctor, and it would going to be look like it's your own decision, or you are not going to do this, and tomorrow he is going to go up and sit in the manager office, and he's going to run the hospital. And if you try to do anything, we are going to close the gates, we change them lock, and we're going to make it a fight. So he responded with a fax 2 hours later to appoint the managers that we have elected.
This kind of democratic uprising worries those in power. While making his rounds visiting patients, Dr. Shafiq explains that the healthcare system has become an important battleground against the current military government.
Of course, the regime have not been changed totally, as we have hoped for when we removed Mubarak. They are trying to manipulate us, to reinvent the regime once more, with new faces. So that's what makes the health issue a central point in the struggle against dictatorship in Egypt, because every percent increase in health budget will take from the budget from the Ministry of Interior and from the budget that is dedicated to the oppressive machine.
Doctors and other medical workers have demanded that national health funds be increased until they reach 15% of the national budget. The additional money, they say, should come from the Ministry of Interior. Right now, the government allocates 3.6% of the national budget for healthcare, while the repressive Ministry of Interior funds an armed force of 1.4 million police. The exact amount of the Ministry of Interior's budget is a state secret.
The military budget is a closed black box, so nobody knows it. Most of this budget is not to provide security for the citizens, but to oppress them. It is part of the oppressive regime. It is a stick that was meant to keep us down. So we are willing to take part of the money going to buy equipment to oppress us, to buy equipment to treat us.
To date, the military has offered small increases in the national health budget, but nothing close to what health workers say is adequate. Ellis J. Goldberg, a political science professor at the University of Washington, who was also a visiting professor at American University in Cairo, says the current military government won't significantly increase the health budget or meet protesters' demands for an increased minimum wage.
I think it's unlikely that the military will grant that, primarily because the military doesn't want to take those kinds of hard decisions. The only reason the military would grant it is if there were some major political disturbance on the part of the workers that threatened the political stability of the country, not simply economic interests.
Professor Goldberg notes that since February, hundreds of workplaces around the country have experienced strikes and demonstrations. They demand a minimum wage of $200 a month. A plethora of independent unions, worker federations, and worker parties arose. To date, some unions have won demands for wage increases or replacement of managers. But Professor Goldberg says the government has resisted more thoroughgoing changes.
The worker strikes are primarily around the issues of job loss, job security, the demand for a £1,200 monthly minimum wage. Often they're over the authority in the factory. That is to say, workers are very unhappy with the factory managers who they see as a corrupt part of the old regime.
Professor Goldberg says economic change is slow because Mubarak cronies still control much of the economy through corruption and political patronage.
In terms of the economy, the real problem was you had a group of probably 40 to 50 people who formed both the top leadership of the then ruling party, the National Democratic Party, and who had significant investments in areas of the economy that benefited from state contracts, tourism, steel, cement, and a variety of other industries. This was a very, very tightly linked group of people, and they used their political power to assure themselves an economic monopoly.
Back in Tahrir Square, protesters are trying to make fundamental, not just cosmetic, changes. In the months that followed the February downfall of Mubarak, many different kinds of people demonstrated here: leftists, moderate secularists, and devout Muslims. Secular protesters acknowledge that they have alienated some in the broader society. Student Shaima Helmi explains.
We're trying to raise awareness in the streets because people started to hate the uprising. The prices are getting high, and people think that this is, the reason is the revolution. So we're trying to convince people that what we are doing is for you, not just for us.
And you don't have to go far to find some of those alienated people.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to Who Won the Egyptian Revolution? A report from Cairo by Rhys Ehrlich.
Muslims gather at a Cairo mosque for Friday prayers. The conservative Islamic group, the Muslim Brotherhood, exercises considerable influence among people here, as well as among peasant farmers, the urban poor, and sections of the middle class. Truck driver Ahmed Fathi reflects the conservative view that anti-government demonstrations should stop.
We should give the government some time. We shouldn't have sit-ins and demonstrations every day. We need time for things to get back to normal.
In the working and lower middle class Sayeda Zanab district, walking distance from Tahrir Square, a barber named Saleh Hamid says he's a Muslim Brotherhood supporter.
He likes the Muslim Brotherhood and he would like to see them in power. They're trying to apply the Islamic law. And we are in a Muslim country, so that's why he likes them.
The Muslim Brotherhood enjoys considerable popular support because it promises to govern Egypt based on Islamic law. It's similar to those politicians in the United States who call for government based on the Ten Commandments. In addition, the Muslim Brotherhood was one of the leading groups to help overthrow Mubarak. Hamid himself attended some of the big anti-government rallies in Tahrir Square.
The whole country was oppressed, and people didn't feel okay. So he said that he's proud to participate in what happened in Tahrir, because everyone was feeling bad during the previous regime.
But now Hamid, like many Muslim brothers, says the demonstrators have gone too far.
The main purpose of the protests was resignation of Mubarak. And he thinks that it's, what they are doing is wrong. We should keep up continuing our work and get back to our works.
Hamid supports the military government, which he says is trying to rule under difficult conditions. He points out that in Libya and Syria, the military didn't support the demonstrators, leading to more deaths and civil war.
He thinks that they are working hard to rule the country, although they are kind of slow. But still, they listen to people's demands and they work on them.
The Muslim Brotherhood and other conservative Islamists won a major victory in March when the military put forward a referendum to legitimize its power. Leftist and secular forces opposed the referendum. The Muslim Brotherhood and other conservatives supported it, claiming a yes vote would maintain the leading role of Islam in Egyptian law. The referendum passed by an overwhelming 77%. Tahrir Square leader Shalabi makes an analogy to the influence of conservative evangelicals in U.S. politics.
You remember how Bush used to win because churches would go out and say that it's a sin to not vote for Bush or to vote against Bush? Well, the Islamists did something very similar here when they said it is your responsibility as a Muslim to vote yes. Otherwise, they might remove Article 2 of the Constitution, which might make Egypt into a secular state. And that's when all hell will break loose and people are running around naked and will be swimming in rivers of alcohol and whatnot.
After being arrested at a demonstration, Shalabi got some insights when he shared a jail cell with conservative Islamist political prisoners.
It's blasphemous to question certain things, and that's why I had to be very clever as an atheist. Obviously, I didn't tell them I was an atheist. I just told them that I'm not a practicing Muslim, or I'm in the process of becoming a practicing Muslim. It's like I'm telling them, yeah, I'm a Muslim. I'm just not praying these days. I'm too lazy. I'm trying to pick up my prayer, you know. But obviously, I wasn't going to tell them that I'm atheist because then I'd lose all my credibility.
Did any of your arguments work, or did they go away unconvinced?
Well, they were convinced I'm this nuthead that is very different. And who argues in a different way and makes these arguments I've never heard before. But they're also convinced that I have credibility, that I'm credible in what I'm saying.
Professor Goldberg says the Muslim Brotherhood and other conservative Islamist parties have considerable popular support.
It's quite likely that the Muslim Brothers will be, if not in power, certainly participants in a ruling coalition. What's not clear at this point is how powerful the parliament will be relative to the presidency. My offhand guess is going to be that much as the Muslim Brothers would like to have a more powerful parliament and a less powerful president, that's not going to happen, that you're going to have a strongly presidential regime it won't be as strongly presidential as it was, but the president will still have quite a bit of power, and that the Muslim Brothers will be a powerful force, if not the dominant force in a parliament.
In recent months, the Muslim Brotherhood has been challenged by an even more conservative movement known as the Salafis. They are an ultra-Orthodox religious movement that combine a strict interpretation of Islam with an extreme right-wing ideology. Many Egyptians believe they are responsible for violent assaults on Sufi Muslim shrines and the burning of Christian churches. Rabab El-Mahdi, a leftist political activist who teaches political science at the American University in Cairo, says the Salafi leaders didn't even participate in the Tahrir Square demonstrations that began January 25th. They came out only after February 11th, when Mubarak resigned.
Up until January 25th, you did not hear about them except when it came to, you know, some woman converting. But 2-3 years ago, you didn't even hear about them. They would stick to their mosques, and in every neighborhood, they know the mosque to go to. But apolitical, so invisible, and then suddenly, after the 11th, they're everywhere. The military is complicit. They're actually allowing them to play leading roles.
Salafis became famous for violent attacks when a Muslim woman wanted to convert to Christianity in order to marry a Christian man, something they say is prohibited by Islam. Professor El-Mahdi says these ultra-conservatives were promoted by the old regime and its allies.
It used to be an apolitical tendency. It was actually nurtured by Saudi money and Amn al-Dawla, the state security apparatus, to counterbalance the Muslim Brotherhood and jihadi Islam, which was very radical. So they basically allowed them a space and allowed the pouring of Saudi money so that they came up with that version of Islam that's very, very socially conservative, much more socially conservative than any of the other tendencies, but very, very apolitical. So they're the people who would say that demonstrating and protesting against the ruler is not acceptable religiously, it's haram. But at the same time, they would demonstrate because they don't want a Christian woman to be Muslim. But you have different variations and versions within the Salafis. They're not one coherent group as the Muslim Brotherhood is. And you have a range of the complete morons, who are just, you know, berserk, to people who you can rationalize with.
In May, a suspected Salafi mob set fire to a Christian church in Cairo. Why would people who claim to be devout Muslims attack churches? Professor El-Mahdi explains.
For them, the Christians, the modern Christians as we know them, are infidels. Because good Christians existed before Prophet Muhammad came. Once Prophet Muhammad came, they should have converted to Islam.
Extreme Salafis constitute a small minority in Egypt, and their attacks are condemned by mainstream Islamists. Back in the Sayyida Zainab neighborhood, Mohammed Said Mohammed stops at a juice stand. He describes himself as a Muslim Brotherhood supporter. He strongly criticizes the church burnings and other violence against Christians.
All these conflicts are completely wrong. We have been living together, Muslims and Christians, for many centuries. It's part of our teaching to treat Christians in a good way. Prophet Muhammad was married to a Coptic woman. Prophet Muhammad told us to take care of the Christians of Egypt specifically.
But Professor El-Mahdi says such a view contains a fatal flaw. Christians and other religious minorities don't want to be taken care of. They want equal rights.
Their understanding of how Islam, for example, is the right religion, by definition, is exclusionary. Their understanding that women are second-class citizens. So imagine if you're a Coptic woman and the Muslim Brotherhood rules. Wow. So you're not even, you're a woman and you're Coptic, so you're like third.
And that's precisely what worries Coptic Christians, who make up about 10% of Egypt's population. Thousands of Coptic Christians rally in Cairo to protest the church burning and demand equal rights. Father Antonius, a Christian leader, complains that so far, the military government has cracked down on Christian protesters, but not arrested the arsonists who burn churches.
They arrested some of the young people yesterday. They didn't commit any crime. They accused them of having weapons when they didn't have any weapons, and one of them has an exam the day after tomorrow.
There's a common pattern to the Muslim-Christian conflict in Egypt. The dispute often surfaces when a Christian woman wants to marry a Muslim man. Extremists accuse the Christian priests of keeping her in a church against her will. Then the extremists go to the church, supposedly to rescue the woman, and a fight breaks out. Tahrir Square leader Shalabi says people on both sides feel threatened.
After spending 4 or 5 days in a political prison with very religious people, I've come to realize that there is this notion of fear that Christianity might grow and out of control. And there's also this notion from the Christians that the Muslims want to take over and turn us into an Iran and that this would be disastrous. And so that's a problem. So I think that the old regime is benefiting from this, and they might be orchestrating it, but it takes very little effort to get this blowing like wildfire.
Father Antonius says the government could undercut extremism by extending full freedom of religion to everyone. Right now, for example, the government must approve the opening of any new church.
To open all of the closed churches and to put on trial all the people, the perpetrators. And also to have justice, because there is no justice in Egypt.
The Egyptian revolution has experienced sectarian violence and the rise of extremist groups, but it also has successes. Back at the Manshaid al-Bakri Hospital, the workers' uprising has improved conditions for both staff and patients. Newly elected administrator Dr. Milad Ismail says patients no longer have to pay for hospital supplies out of their own pockets.
We treat patients for free, but we accept some fees. Basic services are provided, but people must pay for such things as elective surgery. About 50% of our services are free.
The overthrow of the Mubarak dictatorship in February unleashed a volatile mix of political, economic, and religious forces in Egypt. Conservative Islamists are on the move. Parliamentary elections, originally scheduled for September, have now been postponed to November. Tahrir Square leader Tarek Shalabi says leftists and secularists need the time to get organized because their movement is new and inexperienced.
You can't just expect to have a political party up and running in no time. You need like 6 months of complete chaos, disorganization, arriving late to meetings, forgetting the meeting minutes, finding out how to use the proper email account. You know, like it just takes time.
The Muslim Brotherhood and Salafis are also using the time to organize. They've held huge rallies in Tahrir Square as well. The military, secularists, and Islamists will be contending for power for some time. Shalabi says the very future of the revolution is at stake.
And if we give up now, we might end up at a worse position than we were pre-Jan 25.
For Making Contact, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Cairo.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Who Won the Egyptian Revolution, produced by Reese Ehrlich. Special thanks to Shaima Helmi, Mandy Fahmy, and Kirillos Nagy for translation and arranging interviews. Reese Ehrlich received a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting for his work in Egypt. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get our podcasts, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.